This is the JN Podcast. I'm Phil Dave, and coming up on this show, Nadine Batchelor-Hunt, writer and journalist, who also happens to be of the Black Jewish community, tells us about her personal experience as the whole debacle with Black Lives Matter rumbles on for yet another week. CEO of the Commonwealth Jewish Council, Clive Lawton, tells us how his organization has been helping Jewish students in Uganda that have been affected by the outbreak of COVID-19. Mark Cave of the National Holocaust Center and Museum, along with Holocaust survivor Ruth Barnett, talk about an amazing new app that is revolutionizing the way that youngsters are being taught about the Holocaust. And as if all of that isn't enough, we'll hear some wise and comic words from comedian Ashley Blaker, who will be reflecting on some of the events of the past week. But before all of that, it's time to start off this edition of the JN Podcast, as we usually do, with a look through your copy of the Jewish News. Joining me to go through it is news editor Justin Cohen and supplements editor Bridget Grant. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Phil.
Hi, Phil.
Right, let's start off with a look at the front page and a rather, well, striking headline. There's always a striking headline recently, I find, but that's because there's quite a lot of striking news out there. Headline reads, Black Jews tell Jewish news of bitter communal experiences as more than 30 contact the inclusivity inquiry in first week. This, of course, is the ongoing story of the Black Lives Matter movement and how it's affecting the Jewish community.
Absolutely. Loyal listeners to this podcast will have heard last week from Stephen Bush, who, of course, is heading the new inquiry into the experience of Black Jews within the Jewish community. And this week, we felt that as a prelude to that inquiry and really to help set the scene, we would talk in depth to several members of the community. Several of those 30 people, in fact, that have come forward to the inquiry in its first week about their experiences and about the sort of things that they will be talking to the inquiry about. And I think what's striking is that, yes, some people talk about those examples where they've heard the N-word and other derogatory names being used within the community, as those names are used, unfortunately, still outside those communities on rare occasions. But actually, it's the fact that each of them talks in detail about their experience of going into synagogue, about being stared at in communal buildings, of just not being made to feel welcome. One guy we spoke to, Jonas C. Joseph, who again has appeared on this podcast in the past, spoke about how rather than being asked his life story and, you know, and really tested on his Judaism when he enters a building, he'd just like to be welcomed in like any other person would be. And he doesn't need to give his life story each time he enters such a building. And I just think it's that lower level. And yes, it could be curiosity that's driving it, and you know, genuine curiosity. But I think what we've learned over the last couple of weeks and what this inquiry will hopefully also draw out is a greater understanding within the wider community that there are Black Jews. They are fully Jewish, fully interested in the community. They're able to speak Hebrew and all sorts of other things, but they are people that do feel on the margins. And, you know, if any good can come out of the recent events, hopefully it'll be just a greater understanding.
And that is in its entirety on pages 4, 5, 6, 16 and 18. So there is a great deal of coverage in the paper this week on that particular story. And as, of course, we've spoken about it in recent weeks, we're not going to carry on with it in this particular part of the program. Let's move on to some of the other stories. And on page 3, we've got the headline that says Hasmo fights for survival. Hundreds of Hasmonean parents are a little bit worried about the future of their school.
Yeah, there was an emergency meeting on Zoom this week to tell Hasmonean parents really that their school is suffering very difficult financial situations at the moment, and really to emphasize the need for voluntary contributions at this point. As we know, many Jewish schools ask for voluntary contributions for Jewish education and to help fund the school in general. Hasmonean is a school that particularly relies on those voluntary contributions, and they've clearly been suffering, as the parents of the school have been suffering, whether it be under furlough or losing their jobs or financial uncertainty generally. They're not in a position, as much as they were before the COVID crisis, to pay those voluntary contributions. And I think the significant thing here is that it's not just Hasmonean that's going to be affected here. there are other schools that also rely, maybe to a lesser extent, on those voluntary contributions. And I think we are looking to find out over the coming days on what their position is and what they're going to be saying on this.
And you know, Bridget, it's very easy to forget, because obviously Hasmonean is from the more orthodox side of the religion. For those of us who maybe are not as religious and don't necessarily have friends and family associated with Hasmonean schools, just how much the religious institutions are structured and how much they must rely on the generosity of the community.
Yeah, they do rely on it. I mean, you'd be amazed, though, how many parents, when asked for voluntary contributions, are not very good at offering them. They will justify it in that the school is meant to be free. It has state funding in part, however that may be. And there are lots of parents who simply refuse to make voluntary contributions to it. They don't feel, and you know, even the ones who sometimes drive up in Porsches, that is one of the huge problems with it. And that is, you're right, across the board, regardless of how religious the school may be.
I might suggest, though, that those who do drive up in the Porsches have probably blown all their money on the cars. But let's not dwell on that too much.
Yeah, they haven't been driving them, Phil, though, have they? They haven't been driving them of late. They've saved on petrol in lockdown.
Absolutely. So with that money that's saved on the petrol, definitely put that towards our schools and our educational institutions. Let's have a look at page 8, another story. This has gained some traction this week. 145 for Envoy, 650 against. These are petitions that are, well, putting the potential new Israeli ambassador in her place.
Well, yes. So Mark Regev, our current ambassador from Israel to the UK, is heading off this week into the sunset. We don't yet know what beckons for him in his next role. But it really, we've been really lucky, I think, in the UK. After a period of struggling to find an ambassador who could speak English fully, we've had Ron Prosser, we've had Daniel Taub, and now Mark Regev, three of the greatest, I think, advocates and spokespeople for Israel in the world at the moment. We are about to receive the new ambassador, Zippy Hotovely, who is the current settlements minister in Israel. And her own politics aside, she is not an uncontroversial figure. And inevitably, there was going to be some movement calling for her to, for the UK government to reject the appointment of Hotovely to the UK. And there is a precedent for this. In the 1980s, Margaret Thatcher's government refused a particular appointment as ambassador. I think it's highly unlikely we're going to see things going in that direction on this occasion. But inevitably, in a moment of heightened tensions around annexation, her appointment is really raising eyebrows, and various communal figures are even coming out in an unprecedented way and saying that they hope that she will leave her own personal politics at the door or at the LL flight as she arrives. Truth is, though, that when an ambassador is appointed, it's their job to put their politics aside and to represent the position of the Israeli government. The fact is, the Israeli government's position looks to be in favour of annexation, and so there's probably going to be lots of tensions ahead anyway.
I suspect that we will be hearing the name Zippy Hotovely quite a lot over the coming weeks.
In the worst way, you need someone who's going to come and represent Israel to not have any of that baggage. It's hard enough to get respect for Israel in this country when it comes to those things. The last thing you need is someone who is supporting the government line on this.
Now, I am very aware of the time, Bridget, and we've got a lot to talk about with you, because I know in recent weeks that you may have fulfilled a lifelong ambition. I'm not going to say any more than that, other than page 22, and you can say the rest. Who have you been speaking to?
Yes, I think it's coming up for 30 years that I planned, dreamed, and hoped I would one day interview my hero, unarguably the greatest director and writer, Woody Allen. I always imagined, as I say at the start of the story, that it would be in a bar at the Hotel the Carnegie or in a deli for Broadway Danny Rose. I never imagined it would be on the phone, but what a blissful 45 minutes it was. I am more in love with him than I ever was. And his new film, Rainy Day in New York, and his autobiography, Apropos of Nothing, are equally brilliant, and I will not accept any alternative view.
I see. Well, I think that's us put in our place. But based on your interview with him, because obviously, as you mentioned, it was 45 minutes, so you did speak to him for quite a while. What would you say stood out? What did he tell you that maybe you didn't know about him, or really was that moment where you thought, wow, this is it?
Well, when I didn't think he'd talk about his Judaism, and we talked about his bar mitzvah, the fact that he could still remember some of the portion. What I loved about him was that there was no hesitation in answering the questions. I've interviewed many, many famous people over the years, from political leaders to, you know, A-stars, celebrities. And this was without hesitation. He answered honestly, enthusiastically. It was literally, it was the dream interview. Even if I hadn't been a fan, it would have been a dream interview. He is an extraordinary fellow. And everything that's been thrown at him, as we've witnessed in the last few weeks with J.K. Rowling, how easy it is to create opposition, I would say, or a view of someone and destroy their career based on a few people's opinions.
There you go. The full story is on page 22 and 23, double page spread, quite rightly so, as our very own Bridget Grant meets and speaks to Woody Allen. And that's, I'm afraid, all we have time for a look at the paper for this week. But don't forget that you can pick up your copy of the Jewish News every Thursday. You can also read the full paper online if you are isolating. That's jewishnews.co.uk. But for now, news editor Justin Cohen, supplements editor Bridget Grant, thank you both very much indeed.
Thanks, Phil.
Thank you, Phil.
This is the JN podcast. Now, it seems like all too often during the last couple of weeks that we have been starkly reminded of the issues that some members of the, not only just our community, but obviously the Black community at large, have had to go through over the years and possibly have had to suffer in silence. Well, obviously there is a clear turn in the tide, and now we are more aware more than ever of some of those situations. But it's in particular, we focus on this program on how it affects members of the Jewish community who happen to be also members of the Black community as well. And this week, Nadine Batchelor-Hunt, who is a writer and a journalist and former president of the Cambridge University Black and Minority Ethnic Campaign, joins us now on the JN podcast to talk about her experiences. Nadine, first and foremost, thank you for speaking to me on the JM podcast, because I do recognise, I can't absolutely appreciate, but I certainly recognise that this must be a very difficult subject because it is ultimately your life that we're talking about amongst many others. Can you talk a little bit about your experience having all of this stuff brought to the surface that you've gone through yourself?
It was particularly immediately in the aftermath of George Floyd, it kind of felt like the floodgates were open, because a lot of Black people, both in the UK and the US, had just kind of tolerated the day-to-day racism, the unconscious bias when it comes to racism, just microaggressions, just structural issues. And we've just kind of felt ignored. And I remember when I saw Dave at the Brits in February, and he addressed some of these issues, and he was ridiculed, and it just felt like we were never going to be listened to or taken seriously. And then this stuff happened with George Floyd, and suddenly there was a shift in the consciousness of both white people in the UK and the US, and kind of around the world, really. And that's why there's been protests everywhere. And it kind of felt like suddenly this door had been opened of all this pain, and we were finally able to tell people and they would listen. And it in many ways it was a relief, but it was also kind of traumatic, because you were telling these things to people we've been trying to talk to and tell for ages, but we just hadn't been being listened to. So for example, when I saw the video of George Floyd a few months ago, my brother was racially profiled on a train, dragged off the train. He was handcuffed and his feet were put in cable ties and his face was smashed into the floor. And then my mum launched a complaint, and the police said they couldn't provide the footage of the event from their cameras. And then they said there wasn't CCTV. And then later they said there was, but they won't release it. And it was just very stressful to finally have everybody suddenly paying attention to this issue that had been going on for so long. And it almost felt like you're suddenly put in the spotlight and you're finally able to speak, and then you just get overwhelmed. And then in the Jewish community as well, just things like being stared at, being constantly asked how I'm Jewish, how I've learned Hebrew. And even recently I went to a wedding in Israel and I went with my ex-boyfriend and people kept saying to me, oh, is this your first time in Israel? Oh, and it's just like, you clearly don't think I'm Jewish because I'm black, but I am. And it's
Actually, let's talk about that specifically, okay? Because I would imagine that, and I've mentioned a couple of times in the last couple of episodes of the JM podcast, that it's not bad enough having to go through either one prejudice or the other, but you have both in the sense that you have
100%.
You have the prejudice of people looking at the color of your skin, which naturally anyone in their right mind would find abhorrent in this day and age. But then you also have to try and go through the hurdles that come with when you explain that you are Jewish. And we've all been there, you know, the number of times that people have said to me, oh, I didn't know you were Jewish, as if it's a disease somehow, as if there's a problem with it. So you have both of those elements to deal with. And then on top of that, you have to deal with it from within the community as well.
Yeah.
It must be a never-ending saga.
It really is. And you can imagine during the election, it was a very, very, very stressful time for me. You know, serious anti-black racism on one side, serious anti-Semitism on the other side, trying to decide which party was going to pose the least risk to me, receiving anti-Semitic abuse on the left, receiving anti-black abuse on the right, receiving anti-black, anti-Semitic abuse from people who claim to be fighting anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. I mean, at one point I got stalked and I had to meet the police with my rabbi because these people were mocking me for being, you know, having Jamaican ancestry, saying you can't be Jewish. And honestly, like, the alienation I felt after the election, because emotions were so running so high, and a lot of Jewish communal organisations had basically just not listened to any of the concerns of black Jews. I think Mazorti were quite good, but generally, you know, there was a group of us, particularly a few of us journalists, like, asking for recognition. And then we'd see things like the front page of the JC was an advert for the Conservative Party and how it was going to be safe for Jews. And this is in the aftermath of the Windrush. So it was a really, really difficult time, not just on a structural level, but then when you combine it with, how do you know Hebrew? How do you know, how are you Jewish? Being stopped at synagogues. I've recently moved to Manchester and I needed to get some mezuzot for my doors. And I was too anxious to go. I know it sounds stupid, but I've been too anxious to go to a Jewish shop in the area because I just can't deal with the stairs. And I can't deal with people feeling uncomfortable when I'm walking in the shop because I know they feel uncomfortable because they're like, oh, are they Jewish? Why are they in here? And it's just exhausting, and it can feel like a very alienating space. You know, you'll have people that say they're anti-racist, you know, people fighting anti-Semitism who are embroiled in anti-black racism. And you'll say, you have people that say they're fighting anti-black racism, but they're embroiled in anti-Semitism. And especially when the support from the Jewish community wasn't there for black Jews, it honestly just felt like we were just abandoned and our lives didn't matter to anyone. And we were just, you know, we were just an inconvenience for the narratives on either side of the political spectrum. Well, look, and it was just easy to ignore us.
Let's look at it now, because I think it's fair to say that certainly for the here and now, and hopefully for the long term as well, it certainly feels as though the tide has turned.
And so 100%.
People moving forward will probably benefit from someone such as yourself to tell someone not only your experiences, which you've done brilliantly, by the way, so thank you very much indeed for that, and thank you for being so candid, but maybe what would also help is if you tell those who potentially consciously and subconsciously do hurl some sort of abuse at you without realizing it, what it is that they can do to change, what would make your life easier.
So it comes down to education. Like, I know a lot of people have been banging on about this, but, you know, if you're in the classroom and you're told, by the way, in the Torah, there are Jews of colour. By the way, there are Jews of colour in the UK and in the US and in Israel. You know, the Jews of colour aren't just, you know, a lot of people seem to think they're all just in Israel and everything, everywhere else is Ashkenazi. It's not the case. So I think, first of all, just acknowledging the existence of Jewish people of colour and not seeing them as this obscure, distant kind of community that aren't there. In fact, I did a talk with JW3 the other day, and April Baskin, she's a black Jew in America, and she hit the nail on the head. She said, the Jewish community needs to see itself as a multi-ethnic, multiracial community, which it is, and therefore it should see the fights of black Jews, of Mizrahi Jews, of Jews of all races and all ethnicities as the fight for Jewish people. because inherently the Jewish community is a multiracial community. And if we took that approach when we look at anti-racism, being anti-racist in the Jewish community, how we can get into that mindset, it's by acknowledging that we are a multiracial people. And it's by removing the mindset that we're just an Ashkenazi monolith, which I feel like is, even in popular culture, that's how it's presented. And then once we hit that point, that it won't be weird to see a Black Jew at shul, because of course there are Black Jews, and it won't be weird to see a Mizrahi Jew at shul, because of course there are Mizrahi Jews. And I think if you can get to that point, then a lot of it solves itself. History, just recognizing how Black history is Jewish history too, because there are Black Jews. And I think if we can change the way that we see the Jewish community and who is part of it and what our community actually looks like, then we can get change. And I think it starts in the classroom. It also needs to happen in synagogues. It needs to happen in, Jewish youth movements. And also just, in the Torah, like looking at the Jews of color, exploring their lives, like studying people like Zipporah, like, it's celebrating the diversity in the community rather than pretending it's not there or not really caring that it's there, if that makes sense.
It certainly does. And thank you very much indeed for speaking to me on the JN podcast. Just before we let you go, Nadine, I wonder whether or not in pretty much a sentence, because I think that this is a great opportunity to educate people right here, right now. Can you give us an example of unconscious bias that you've witnessed from, say, the community? So this is a classic example of how someone listening may have said something to offend without even realizing it.
Yeah, like, how do you know Hebrew?
Perfect. Like, well, there you go. What better example than that? Thank you very much indeed. And I really hope that for your sake and for, I'm not going to say Black Jews, I'm going to say for Jews around the world, that this will hopefully re-educate all of us for the better and hopefully bring some sense of, well, decency and normality to all of our lives. Thank you very much indeed, Nadine Batchelor-Hunt, for speaking to us on the JN podcast.
Thank you.
This is the JN podcast. Now, headline this week: grant to support 40 Jewish students in Uganda hit by economic impact of COVID-19. I think it's very easy for us as a community to focus very much on UK soil and say how we as a community have been affected, but very rarely do we think about how life has been impacted across the old borders when it comes to COVID-19. But luckily, there are organisations that are paying attention to such things. The Commonwealth Jewish Council is one of them, and their chief executive officer is Clive Lawson. I'm delighted to say that we can speak to Clive now on the JN podcast. Clive, welcome, and thank you very much indeed for not only speaking to me, but also for what you're doing. Perhaps you'd be so kind as just to inform us exactly what it is your organisation does and how it does it.
Oh, okay. So the Commonwealth Jewish Council brings together the 30 to 40 Jewish communities of the Commonwealth. There are 54 countries in the Commonwealth. Some of those don't have Jewish communities, but about 37, 38 do. Some of those are big ones. Everybody would know them. The UK, obviously, or Canada or Australia or South Africa. And some of them are mid-sized. If you sit and think about them, you might think of New Zealand or maybe India, perhaps or Zimbabwe, perhaps something like that, or Kenya, maybe you think of. And some of them are tiny, Sri Lanka, Lesotho, St. Lucia. So there are, as I say, 38 or so of these Jewish communities around the world. The Commonwealth Jewish Council brings them together so they're less isolated and give some good ideas of things they can do. Bermuda recently joined in with Mitzvah Day, for example. And we also have a Jewish voice at the Commonwealth. So we're one of the 70 organizations accredited to the Commonwealth. So when those Commonwealth governments come together or different representations of the different countries, we are there adding a Jewish voice, we hope principled and inspiring Jewish voice to those discussions. So, for example, we're very much involved in thoughts about the environment. We have a campaign called Small Islands, Big Challenges. So some of the island nations of the world are due to disappear, literally, physically disappear. Jews know about the fear of losing a homeland and what that might do to who you are and what your culture is. So we have things to say about that. We've also encouraged the Commonwealth generally to take trees more seriously, being partners with the Queen's Commonwealth canopy to plant more trees around the world. Indeed, the Mauritian Jewish community president our representative on the Commonwealth Jewish Council from Mauritius, has personally been responsible for planting 400,000 trees in Mauritius. Wow.
Now, there's absolutely no denying that all of this work is fantastic and incredibly impressive, and I would love it if we could look at this maybe another time in more detail.
Yes.
But the reason why we're speaking to you today is because of the impact that COVID-19 has had on some of these Commonwealth communities. Yeah. And I understand that it is your organisation that has made sure that they don't suffer quite as much as they might have done otherwise. Tell us a little bit about A, how they've been impacted, and B, what it is that you're doing to help them.
Well, generally speaking, it's worth remembering that, of course, Britain has done far less well in relation to COVID-19 compared to most of these countries. And indeed, countries in, say, the Caribbean, for example, have had really few challenges. And in Africa at the moment, it might be growing, but in Africa at the moment. So a country like Mozambique, for example, in which we have a lovely community in Maputo, there are about half the population of Britain, about 35 million people, and they've had a small handful of deaths from COVID-19 currently. In Jamaica, which is, of course, a much smaller place, they've had 7 deaths from COVID-19. So some of these countries are coping far, far better than we are. And of course, many African countries have had the experience of Ebola, and they therefore are much better ready to establish a lockdown that people know how to immediately cope with and know the dangers of the threatening and deadly pandemics or epidemics like this. So the specific case that we were involved in was in Uganda. Uganda has a Jewish community called the Abayudaya. Most people won't know anything much about them, and they are black African Jews. There's about 4,000 or 5,000 of them, and the vast majority of them live in classic African rural villages and have a mental image of little thatched mud huts, and that is indeed where most of the Abayudaya live, in a province of Uganda called Mbale. But there's a small handful of these Jews who live in the capital city in Kampala, because they're at university there. And unlike students here, there's no grants or loans or anything. You've got to earn a living if you want to be a student. So they had part-time jobs. And they have a Jewish community there in Kampala with a shul and services every Shabbat and so on. But Kampala had a lockdown like so many other places. There wasn't a lockdown so much in the rural areas, and most of these people are subsistence people. So long as their farms are continuing to produce food, they can continue to live. But in Kampala, they had part-time jobs. All of those disappeared overnight. And these 40 Jews in Kampala, students, had nothing to live on whatsoever.
Clive, I have to tell you, I get very disappointed on this programme because we have such terrific guests, and sadly, I don't have a great deal of time to speak to them. However, I would love it if you tell us this. It all sounds really humbling and fascinating work, and bravo, say all of us, I'm quite sure. If anyone would like more information or potentially would perhaps like to get involved, maybe with the Commonwealth Jewish Council, if they want to help at all, where should they go for more information? Because I think there's a lot more to be explored here.
Okay, our website's very easy, www.cjc.org.uk, O-R-G.uk.
Fantastic. Clive Lawson, the Commonwealth Jewish Council's CEO, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us on the JN podcast. And I should say, just before we let you go, that I have long admired the way that you have this most amazing ability to bring people together from all over the place, because, of course, there are some people who may or may not know that you, of course, are the founder of Limud. So just in case people are wondering exactly how it is your background is so absolutely entrenched in bringing people together, what better example than that? So thank you, sir.
Thank you, Phil. Thanks very much indeed.
This is the JN Podcast. Now, a Holocaust app for primary school children was released for National Refugee Week on Monday, with users following a Jewish boy through Berlin in the 1930s. This sounds like, to me, a fascinating way of combining the new with the old. I suggest that we find out more about it. We'll speak to Mark Cave, who's the CEO of the National Holocaust Center and Museum, in just a moment. But first, I think we need to hear what it was like in 1930s Berlin from Ruth Barnett, who joins us now. Ruth, thank you so much for speaking to me on the JN podcast. Let's start off with that, because this is obviously a very modern way of getting people to understand what life may have been like in those days, but you lived through it.
Yes, indeed. And thank you for inviting me on this. I was born in Berlin in 1935. It was already Hitler's Third Reich since 1933 and was changed completely. Berlin was an exciting, state-of-the-art, cosmopolitan city. My dad was a judge. My mum ran a cinema advertising business. And we had a glorious future in front of us till the Nazis came to power. And then it all very, very quickly turned against the Jewish community in particular. And we had to get out.
What's your earliest memories of the darker times? Because you say that you were obviously born into the middle of it, or certainly at least the beginning of it. What were your earliest memories of the not so pleasant times?
I was only four when I left Berlin on the Kinder transport. I do remember anxiety, being left for days on end with my grandmother. My mother was not Jewish, so her mother it was safer to be with than in my own family because my father was Jewish. I remember rather little of that time, but I remember the journey to England vividly.
And of course, Mark, that this is part and parcel of the problem. Let's bring in Mark Cave now, who is CEO of National Holocaust Centre and Museum, as I said. And of course, Mark, that this is part and parcel of the problem is that those who are, thank God, still with us are hopefully too young to remember what some of those times were like. And of course, this new application is going to bring life in 1930s Berlin to life, to a whole new generation.
Yes, I hope so. And I think so. Did you know, by the way, that Ruth was actually very involved in the making of the app too, to make sure that it, you know, it really did, it was as accurate as possible?
I did know that. And you know what we're going to do is, Ruth, we're going to explore that in just a moment. So don't you go anywhere, let me tell you.
Okay. All I'd say, actually, is that there is nothing better in the end than hearing the story direct from people like Ruth. So anything else is a substitute. And the point of making this app is to involve whoever the audience might be. And essentially, that means sort of 9 to 10 year old primary school kids, but to involve them and immerse and absorb them in a way that talking with Ruth might also do.
And you know, it's also quite a clever way as well of educating children for this generation, because let's be honest, there's very few who are far from a piece of technology such as a mobile phone that may be capable of downloading an application. And what better way to tell youngsters how life used to be like for some than actually through the way that life is for them now?
Well, there are plenty of good ways. I think there's some marvelous books and films and all sorts of things. I think it's a question of horses for courses. There is a school of thought, which is that, I suppose, conventional, if I can call it that, literature, film and documentary is so well established, it's almost establishment, and it's therefore easy to dismiss for educational purposes. You know, it makes a short-term impact on you, like watching the latest episode of Coronation Street, and then you forget it and move on to the next thing. So the argument is that by putting the audience into the story, literally, through role play, by assuming the part of Leo, that they will, the facts and the emotions will cling to them a little more.
So this application, as you identify, does put people in the position of Leo, who was a young Jewish boy growing up in Nazi Germany, who is eventually forced to flee. Now, obviously, an application like this deserves some element of authenticity. And to make sure that it was done so properly, Ruth, you were also involved in the actual process, as we've heard already, of actually making sure that it was as true to life as possible. What did you have to do for that to be the case?
Well, indeed, I was involved, and I fought very hard that there should not be a lone Jewish boy. There should be girls brought in too, which Leo has a lot of friends, and there are various different characters to identify with. And this is really an outstanding innovation, and the Holocaust Center is the organisation above all others for innovation and breadth of vision. That's what I like about the Holocaust Centre. And apart from this wonderful new idea, which you can have your own download into your own system to use, it's well worth a visit to the centre itself.
Little. God bless you, Ruth. Thank you for saying that.
And may I just say that Mark is not even paying Ruth to say that, so there you go. But Mark, what
you don't
I do
know that.
Yes. But Mark, what I do want to look at is how technology has revolutionized the way that we do teach Holocaust education now, because it must have played some part, whether it actually be in the museum itself, whether it be the resources online, or indeed something as fantastic. And it seems really strange to say fantastic, because obviously it's quite a dark subject, but this application is a very clever and innovative way, as Ruth says, of teaching such a subject. So how has technology played its part?
Yeah. It's an enabler, okay? And I absolutely love gadgets and tech, but it is a means to an end. Successful use of technology, I think, is when you actually forget that it's a piece of tech. You're in a story. You're fascinated. You're on the hook. Technology for technology's sake bothers the hell out of me. I'm a student of Yuval Harari, who believes that basically we're, you know, humanity is in a battle for its very destiny, that AI will take over and all life's meaning will disappear. So we are very, very careful to put technology in the service of humanity, not to dominate it. And so, as I said at the outset, the most important thing is authentic stories best told by the people who were there. The next best thing is to use technology to try and recreate some of the emotion and authenticity of that as best you can.
It certainly sounds like it to me that that's what you have achieved with this application. So congratulations. It really does sound a really terrific way of teaching such a very delicate and to some possibly scary subject, I'd imagine, at that age. Just remind us, to those who would like to learn more, what the name of the application is and where they can find it.
It's an interactive refugee story game. Gamers will know what I mean by a story game. It's on the Apple App Store at the moment. We'll launch it on Android in the next couple of months. And what you should search for is The Journey - Leo's Story. The Journey, Leo's Story.
Amazing. Well, Mark Cave, CEO of the National Holocaust Centre and Museum, and Holocaust survivor Ruth Barnett, thank you very much indeed to both of you for telling us about it on the JM podcast.
With pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
This is the JN podcast. That's nearly it for this edition. But just before we go, I would suggest we've got time for some wise and comic words from comedian Ashley Blaker.
Hello. Ashley Blaker here once again for the fifth time, I think I've lost track myself. All I know is I've been doing this podcast every week for a while now, and I'd like to think we've become friends in this period. I really do genuinely believe that. We've become friends, and when the coronavirus has fully disappeared, I'd like to imagine that maybe we'll meet up, have a drink in the pub, maybe we'll just break bread and share some schmaltz herring at a shul kiddush, and I think we'd enjoy that. And actually, that brings me to what I wanted to talk to you about today, which is shul, synagogue. Because obviously synagogues have been closed for some time, unless you belong to some of the more orthodox synagogues, including my one, which are still very much closed, officer. And those 10 men only happen to be here gathered for private prayer, their own private prayer. No. Just the fact that there are 10 of them, please don't be misled by that. Anyway, we've mostly been praying on our own. And I've actually really enjoyed it. I must be honest with you. I'm not sure I'd ever want to go back to shul properly. You know, I wish myself a Shabbat Shalom. And then I give myself some very nice sweets. The only thing is a few weeks ago I said something in my sermon that I didn't agree with. And now I vowed never to set foot in my own home again. I realised that wasn't actually that practical. So what I've done is I've set up my shul in one room in the house. And then in another room, I've designated the shul that I never go to. And cleverly, I made that the kitchen, as I never went in there anyway. Although, actually, last week, I didn't end up praying at all because I stupidly put myself on security duty. I won't make that mistake again. But obviously, there are, as I alluded to, many idiots out there who refuse to pray on their own despite the laws of social distancing. And if you're not really aware of this, it's because most practices in Orthodox Judaism do require the participation of other Jews. So, for example, for prayers, we need 10 Jewish men over the age of 13. For grace after meals, we need 3 Jewish men over the age of 13. For a Barry Manilow concert, we need 3,000 Jewish women over the age of 70. When Barry Manilow came out the closet, it was a day of mourning for many older Jewish women. My mother hasn't been the same since. By the way, if you're listening, Mum, hello. She won't be happy at me making jokes about her. She never likes her. And whenever I do make jokes about her, she always reminds me of the fifth commandment. Thou shalt honour your mother and father. But I'll be honest with you, this commandment is quite a challenging one for me. Because honouring your mother and father is the precise opposite of what every comedian has ever done. Although, that said, Orthodox Jews love trying to find loopholes, so this may explain the origin of the mother-in-law joke. You get to make jokes about parents, but they aren't technically yours. Doesn't always work. I once made a joke about not being breastfed by my mother-in-law. It sounded very inappropriate. But we do love loopholes. I got an email only yesterday about how now synagogues are open for private prayer, we're allowing 10 men to gather for their private prayer on a Shabbos morning starting at 9 a.m. And I think it's because we absolutely love all these kind of things. We love it. Those men that you might see secretly praying together in gardens or what have you will have justified it, arguing that they were technically 2 meters apart. And you know they would have had enormous Talmudic arguments about exactly how you measure the 2 meters. Do you measure from toe to toe or from the brim of the hat? Can you round up to the nearest meter? Does it change if you're in a walled city? Because this is what we do. So take tefillin, right? The leather boxes and straps we have to wear. How do we measure the width of the straps? Well, we don't use centimeters because that would be confusing for the rest of the world who don't use metric measurements. So what do we use instead? The width of a kernel of barley. That's better. Now no one in the world knows how wide they need to be. And then there's the sukkah that we have to sleep in during Sukkot, the festival of tabernacles. How high does it have to be? We don't measure it in centimetres. We don't even measure in barley kernels. We measure in fists. Now please feel free at this point to write your own jokes about using fists. I'm an Orthodox Jew and couldn't possibly make that kind of joke. And in case you're wondering how wide is a fist, no judgment. Predictably, none of the rabbis agree. So one rabbi says it's 3.15 inches, whereas another rabbi claims it's 4 inches. Typical man, always claiming it's an inch bigger than it really is. Well, I've got to go now because I've actually got to find a loophole that allows me to get out of doing this podcast every week. I've checked the contract and I can't find one, but I'm sure if I look hard enough, it will become apparent. So keep well this week. I will speak to you next week. Goodbye.
Thank you very much to Ashley Blaker there for his wise and comic words reflecting on the times in which we live in. And that's it for this edition of the JN Podcast. Time now to say thank you to all of our guests, to Nadine Batchelor-Hunt, Clive Lawton from the Commonwealth Jewish Council, Mark Cave from National Holocaust Centre and Museum, alongside Holocaust survivor Ruth Barnett. And of course, we mustn't forget to say thank you to our paper review team. They were Justin Cohen and Bridget Grant. And of course, we also have to say thank you to you for listening. And I'm not going to forget to say thank you to Justin Cohen, who's also produced this episode of the JN Podcast. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast application. That way you'll hear any previous episode or be informed when new episodes become available. And don't forget that for more information on any of the stories that we've featured, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. And if you'd like to comment, well, then we'd love to hear from you. Email us on editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. From me, Phil Dave, do join us next time here on the JN Podcast. Goodbye.